Rappin' with Reef Boam is sponsored by Champion Lighting and Supply, Polo Reef, and Fauna Marine.
Hey, hey, what's happening, everybody? And welcome back to another episode of Rappin' with Reef Boam. I'm your host, Keith Berkelhammer. So tonight, I welcome back a very special guest who was on the live stream a couple of years ago by himself, and then also with the Jake Adams tribute show, Vincent Chalias. Vincent, welcome back to the show, man.
Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah. For those that don't know Vincent, he is a marine biologist who is a coral farming pioneer. He is also a diver and a passionate underwater photographer. We're going to see that photography, a lot of that tonight. He's shared a lot of photos from his dive trip. Or trips, I guess, in the Red Sea. So I'm really excited to go through all that stuff. And I'm gonna I told Vincent before we got on just before that I'm gonna be butchering the scientific names. So this is gonna be a shit show in terms of my pronunciations on these corals and fish. But we'll have a good time with it. So he's a photographer. He also so he's utilizing that photography to help document corals and contribute to photos. And articles to a number of publications in Europe and the U.S. He set up the first Indonesian coral mariculture farms at the beginning of the century and spent over 20 years in Indonesia running them. These days, Vincent, is this still true, Vincent? You're more focused on reef restoration?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've done my time in coral farming for the ornamental industry. So now I spend more time doing coral reef restoration.
Gotcha.
So yeah, give me the. I spent 20 years dealing with airlines and payments and all these kind of things. Now I have the freedom, you know, to spend more time in the water.
Well, that's a very important thing. So before we start chatting with Vincent, I want to thank the sponsors of this program, and I want to thank them. They're really important because they mean a lot to have their support and to help foster this learning environment and to allow me to have these awesome guests on. So really appreciate them. Polo Reef, make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday, part two, where Andrew discovers mysterious white spots and many coral colonies. It calls for an emergency dive in the aquarium. Join them as they try to figure out what is happening. And also check out part one that dropped last week. Make sure to subscribe to their YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Todd and his crew will be at Restock Chattanooga on August 24th and 25th, so stop by and say hello. And then finally, Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I am now a certified Fauna Marine ICP Test Advisor, so if you want help interpreting results, then select reefbum.com. Select reefbum. All right, so Vincent, you told me you're on a you're not actually in Bali, you're on an island off of Bali, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I have a project in the south of Bali where we planted 170,000 corals, and here to check out how everything is going before we plant the next round of 10,000 corals. So yeah, I'm organizing, you know, the planting for another 10,000 corals.
How long does that sort of project take to plant that many corals?
Oh, the planting goes quick, you know. I mean, 10,000 corals would be done in a month.
Wow.
We employ local communities here, and we give them the opportunity to restore their own reef. So that's fine. Manpower is not an issue in Indonesia. The difficulty is the growing process and making sure everything is fine, you know. Every time there is a big storm, you need to go there, out there, you know, and clean the mess and remove parasites such as Drupella or cornerthorn starfish. Make sure the boats have moorings, you know, so they don't throw out the anchors. All these kind of problems.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really it's not, the corals are fine. they're growing very well. There's no problem. It's just making sure, you know, that everything, there is no distraction, no other external things that come and disturb this.
I can imagine there could be a lot of things that potentially could upset the corals, but I'm assuming that you do have you know, some that don't make it, but hopefully the majority do.
Yeah, we have pretty good result. You know, I mean, we can you can check our, you know, I mean, like we have before after pictures. You know, I mean, it's very happy. I mean, I'm doing 25 years working for the aquarium industry. You know, growing fragments of, I mean, growing corals. I know how to select a good location.
let's explain to folks.
So it makes things very easy when you select the right place.
So let's just quickly explain to folks. We're seeing comments about the roosters they're hearing in the background and the motor vehicle.
It's rural Indonesia. You know, there are roosters everywhere. Sorry about that. The ocean on one side, you know, and the rooster in the back. It's early morning also, you know, so
crowing for the sun that's coming up there.
Yes, I mean, the sunrise was just 30 minutes ago, you know, so
Okay, well, they'll calm down then later on the show.
Yes.
so we're this is a really cool thing, man, because you're I mentioned all the photos and what have you that from your these were several dives that you had done in the Red Sea to document corals and some fish that a lot of the stuff we haven't seen in the hobby, right?
Yes, so I mean, I spent the last 2 months planting 50,000 corals in the Red Sea. So I got to handle a lot of Red Sea corals, and I got to dive the Red Sea, you know, which is a very, very different environment than what we have in Indonesia. It's desert next to coral reefs, while here we have rainforest next to coral reefs, you know. So in Indonesia, you have a huge input of nutrients all year long, and the water is never very, very clear, while in the Red Sea, you have no rain, no nutrients entering the system. So it's very, very, very different. Here we have very large colonies of corals, while in the Red Sea, everything is minimalist, you know. The maximum size you're going to find, like, is 2 meters.
So
while in Indonesia, you easy.
I was going to say, why is that?
While in Indonesia, you find colonies of more than 10 meters. It's food. It's all about food, you know. I mean, like, the water is clear in the Red Sea. There is just no nutrient, no food. Even the fish are smaller in size, you know. I mean, like, yeah, I dove yesterday here, and I was like, finally, you know, some real-sized fish, you know, some proper-sized fish. So yeah, because there is not much nutrients getting into the water through rivers, so the corals and the fish are starved a little bit in the Red Sea.
Interesting. You know, so I was reading something posted on the Florida Marine website. It said there's ongoing shifts in water temperature and nutrient availability, and I read in this research article on that website that the southern half of the Red Sea turns in nutrient-laden water from the Indian Ocean and rises to the surfaces and inundates coastal reefs. This influx of nutrients isn't enough to damage the reefs by itself, but when combined with the temperature extremes, it can be deadly. Can you talk to us? Does that have something to do in terms of...
Well, I mean, there's different kind of nutrients, you know. I mean, when you have a rain, you know, it brings nutrients, minerals, you know, from the shore, you
right.
know, and this quickly transforms to a phytoplankton bloom, you know, and then after you have the whole chain of things, you know. But after you have DOC, you know, that can create pollutions and can create problems. So it's complex, you know, this story of nutrients, you know, but if it's the right nutrients, you know, it's usually very good for the corals, and if it's the wrong nutrients, then it's bad. But yeah, I mean, in Indonesia, you know, I mean, you have rain all the year, you know, I mean, everywhere. So I've seen reefs right in front of rivers, you know, I mean, it's not always the best, you know, when there is too many rivers, obviously there is not many reefs, you know, but when there is small rivers everywhere, the reef benefits from that a lot, and you see a lot of life. While in the Red Sea, you know, I mean, like, I don't see those blooms of life, and I don't see those huge aggregation of fish and like I see here.
Right.
It's very different.
Interesting. Rob upstate New York.
And yeah,
go ahead.
I don't know why, you know, just the size of corals, you know, is just so much smaller there. You know, it's hard to find any corals, you know, bigger than 3 feet. There is some, you know, a few, you know, but here in Indonesia, you know, it's just everywhere. It's just giant corals everywhere. While over there, there is none. It's just small pieces of corals everywhere. You know, it's very colorful. The reef in the Red Sea are very colorful because it's dominated by pink Posiliopora, Damicornis, and Stylophora. Yeah. And then you have blue Porites and some few blue Acropora on top, you know, so it's very contrasting. It's very colorful, while in Indonesia, it's more shades of brown and dark green. So it's more colorful there. But yeah, just the size is not many.
So you're saying that the reefs there at the Red Sea are healthy, they're colorful. It's just basically the size because of nutrients. They're not getting the same kind of nutrients, perhaps, as they are in other areas like Indonesia.
Yes, I mean, it's the Red Sea is what diversity is. That's what they told us, you know, like a reef thrive in places without any nutrients, you know, in very poor water. And then you come to Indonesia and then you realize that there is a lot of nutrient, but also there is a lot of flow here, while there is no flow in the Red Sea, you know. So this is what makes it possible, you know, that actually to absorb all these nutrients, you know, maybe, you know, I think that's the main reason, you know. It's accumulation of high nutrients with a lot of flow. While in the Red Sea, there is no nutrients and no flow.
What when you say low nutrients, is there like a general level that you could say in terms of nitrates and phosphates in the Red Sea versus Indo?
I haven't tasted any water yet. You know, I mean, I just been there for 2 months. You know, and we are on a contract. You know, and then we have some targets to reach. You know, so we are running after the targets. Right now, it's 33 degrees Celsius over there, which is very, very warm, so we have to stop activities because there is a bleaching going on. So we have to wait until the end of the bleaching before we can start working again. But I don't see, you know, I mean, huge algae issues there, you know, so I don't think, I mean, when I talk about nutrients, you know, I don't think of nitrites and phosphates. I think of more ammonia and other form of nitrogen, you know, and than directly, you know, nitrates or phosphates.
Right, right.
So it's a different form of nutrients, I think.
Gotcha. I want to thank Rob Upstate New York for that super chat. Thank you very much, Rob. Comments, love the show. Vincent, is there a donation site to help your work? Do you have a site that people can donate?
It's called Ocean Gardener, you know, I mean, oceangardener.org. We have a website, you know, you can go and support us there.
Oceangardener.org?
Yes.
Okay. Gotcha.
That's the one.
Intrinsic Reef is asking, in a previous interview, Vincent mentioned that he was sick of the tenuous, the bifaria demand. Has that craze died down on any of his, on his end?
No, I think it's still, I mean, I'm not very involved with the aquarium trade at the moment, you know, but I can see still the same thing, you know, tenuis, millepora, and torches are still the bread and butter.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool, you know, I mean, it's, I have no problem with this. There is few other species, you know, like Anthocercis, you know, that are popular, you know, but it's still the same thing. There is nothing new, you know, I mean, as when I look at the website, you know, it's still the same corals, you know, that are popular that they were 2 or 3 years ago.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't think it's getting very, very complicated to go and look for new corals, you know. I mean, apparently, you know, the wild corals from Indonesia is going to be shut down by spring next year.
Okay.
The last wild Indonesian corals, you know, will come in during spring next year. And then after that, you know, it's only going to be mariculture, you know, and it's very difficult to go and look for exotic species or exotic corals, you know, and put them into production and wait for 2 years before you can sell them. You know, it's getting very, very complicated to look for anything special and new.
Skier, sailor, biker guy. Are there other interesting and exciting corals out there in Indo that we don't see reaching the aquarium trade? I guess it depends if colorful or if they get found.
I think there is still things, you know, that need to explore, you know. I mean, they're just not in the very shallow water, or they are in places which are a little bit far away. But I think there is still some very interesting things that are not entering the trade right now.
Right, and so when's that ban going into effect?
Oh, it's not the ban, you know. I mean, it's just that they extended the wild quota, you know, until 2024. You know, so this year is the last set of wild coral quota that are. I mean, it's Indonesia. Everything's possible, you know. So maybe they're gonna. I'm not involved with it, you know. But the last news that I got, you know, that it's the last year.
Yeah. So getting back.
So I mean, I think it's a good thing, you know, because. I mean, nobody's going to be able to import wild coral anymore, you know, so people will have to farm them, you know, and it's going to bring value, you know, to the coral farmers.
Right, right. Yeah, no, for sure.
So yeah, it's a good thing.
So, all right, getting back to the Red Sea, you know, it's unique, right, because there's a lot of corals in the Red Sea that can't be found anywhere else. And I read that as much as 14% of the Red Sea corals, fishes, and the mollusks can't be found nowhere else, you know, so... Why is that the case? Why is it because of that whole nutrient, the low nutrient, low flow type of thing?
No, it's because during glaciation event, you know, during ice age, the level of the Red Sea, when the water level was 100 meters lower, the Red Sea was isolated. So for many, many years, you know, when the temperature was cold, the level was 100 meters lower, and then it was completely locked. So there was no exchange with the Indian Ocean. So a lot of species, you know, kind of evolved by themselves within the Red Sea.
Gotcha.
So this is something funny, you know, I mean, because when I look at the fish, even fish that you can find there and you can find in Indonesia, for example, like I always take the six-line wrasse.
Uh-huh.
It's a good example, you know. If you look at the one in the Red Sea, they are just so much more colorful than the one that you find in Indonesia.
Oh.
All the fish, it's what I enjoy the most so far, you know. I mean, I'm not very impressed with the corals. There is some few species that are interesting, like Acropora emprichi, Variolosa, Squarosa. Those three species of Acropora are very colorful and very pretty, you know. But otherwise, the fish are just very, very colorful, you know. They are very striking compared to the fish in Indonesia, you know. So even the species that I'm used to seeing in Indonesia, when I look at them in the Red Sea, you know, I'm like, wow. They are on steroids here. They are just so much more colorful than they are. I don't know if it is because of the higher salinity, or they have been separated, or it's if you look at the genetics, you could actually separate them from the one from the Indian Ocean. But fish in the Red Sea are definitely more colorful than the fish in the rest of the Pacific.
A comment and a question. Messiah Mitra. In Red Sea, the light underwater was a bit greenish and very clear, which was very pleasing for the eyes, at least in my experience. Is that your experience?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the water is definitely a lot clearer than it is in Indonesia, you know. So the visibility is much, much better, you know. So it's nice to... And the coral formation also a lot different because there is no current for two things, you know. First of all, the corals have a much denser skeleton that the one in Indonesia. They are very hard to cut. So we cannot cut them with coral cutter. We need to use hammer and chisel because their skeleton is denser. And because there is no current, so the reef formation can manage to form some very high columns, like 10 meter high, skinny columns, you know, going out from the seafloor all the way to the surface, you know. This would be knocked down in Indonesia because there is so much coral and the coral skeleton is not as dense.
Gotcha.
This would be knocked down very quickly in Indonesia. But over there, you know, they keep on growing, you know. So the scenery, you know, the landscape, you know, underwater is actually very interesting in the Red Sea.
So, all right, a couple more questions. Heron Aquatics. Keith, please ask Vincent what does he see the future of the hobby with bands and et cetera. Could he farm in the Red Sea and provide those to the industry?
Oh, this I don't know. You know, I don't think there is any country, you know, around the Red Sea that will allow actually export for aquariums.
Really?
It's I don't see it, you know. I mean, where I am, that's definitely a no. On the other side, in Egypt side or in a smaller country like Djibouti, you know, maybe, you know, but yeah, somebody would have to go and invest in coral farming, and to be honest with you, you know, it's not profitable, you know, so it's not profitable enough, you know, to, especially, you know, I mean, like you would sell, you know, I mean, maybe 100 colonies of each corals, you know, and then after everybody would frag them in the Western world, you know, and then that would be over.
Oh.
I mean, there is corals, you know, I mean, like the Milka Stylophora is coming from the Red Sea originally.
Oh, yeah.
So there are some few corals that are out of the Red Sea, and it's a perfect example, you know, because just a small frag of Stylophora from the Red Sea that went into Europe, you know, and then end up in all the aquarium all around the world.
So Chris Carney's in the house. What's happening there, Chris? He says, hey, Vincent.
How are you, Chris?
We got the Meckleys, Chris and Amanda. Amanda says no permits available for hard corals from the Red Sea.
Yeah.
Did I miss anything?
It's a shame. You know?
Yeah.
There are a lot of interesting corals there.
So here's an interesting comment question from John Wright. The question is, why do we want more rare corals when we have so many gorgeous ones available? Are we looking for the unobtainable? There's always something, right?
It's humans.
Yeah.
It's a human thing. We always want more.
Yeah.
Always want what is more difficult to get. So yeah, it's and people always pay high price, you know, for things that are difficult to get.
Exactly.
So yeah. We're all looking for the Holy Grail.
Yeah. this is an incredible nugget of information. It's estimated that nearly 3/4 of all species inhabiting coral reefs worldwide have yet to be discovered. Is that an accurate number? Is it even higher in the Red Sea?
How much did you see that? How much did you
say? 3/4, 75% of all species inhabiting have yet to be discovered. That's I read that I think in that same publication. I don't know.
No, I'm sure there is a lot of, I'm in the mesophotic zone, you know, like below 60 meters, you know, is unknown, you know, to, so there are many species of mesophytic. There is a lot of reefs, you know, that are mesophotic, you know, that we can find below 60 meters and that we don't know about. But 3/4 seems a little bit high to me.
Sounds high. Okay.
Yeah, sounds high. Sounds high. But I'm sure there is a lot of species, you know, that from deep water areas, you know, that are still unknown to science.
Chris Carney's asking, are the skeletons denser in the Red Sea because of the availability of minerals?
Yes, I think so. You know, I mean, this is something that I experienced already in coral farms. You know, I used to keep my coral farms, you know, I mean, at higher salinity to increase growth, and it would just make things coral more colorful. And so I used to keep the salinity always a little bit higher.
When you say higher salinity, what are you talking about?
So I used to keep at 36 gram per liter instead of 33, you know. So, 36 to 38.
Oh, wow.
That's yeah. And it's easier to keep the minerals high, and the corals kind of enjoy it. Of course, it's not good for the fish, but because they have to spend more energy, you know, to keep fresh water into their body. So they kind of, I mean, if it's healthy fish, it's no problem, you know. But if it's a new coming exhausted fish, you know, then it's gonna be a little bit hard for them to adapt. But
right.
If it's healthy fish, it's okay, you know. But yeah, for corals, it's higher salinity is always a little bit better.
What in terms of identifying new species of coral, is a lot of it taxonomy and DNA testing? Does that come into play when trying to identify new species of coral?
Yes. So there is many issues regarding this. So first of all, now to identify new species, you have to go through the taxonomy and you have to go through the genetics, which kind of double the work. And so it's already complicated to go through all the museum collection and see, you know, what specimen, you know, is available, you know, there and compare the taxonomy, you know, with a specimen, you know, from all around the world.
Yeah.
But then on top of it, you have to do this, the genetic, knowing that the genetic every 10 years kind of is revolutionized every 10 years, you know, so you have to use, so the genetics that was done 10 years ago, you know, cannot be used, you know, again, 10 years later. And after, you know, there is one question that is very important. What is how many different DNA do you need to separate two species?
Yeah.
It's so to create a new species, I mean to identify a new species, you need to have the taxonomy, you know, that have show some differences, and you need to have the genetics, you know, that show some differences, you know. So it's a bit tricky, you know.
Yeah, that's a complicated thing, and it's changing too, right? There's some species that have been are being reclassified.
Yes, so I mean, I took that picture of this Macropharyngodon, you know, in the Red Sea, you know. So I forgot the name of it, you know. Macropharyngodon Maris rubri, sorry.
Is that a picture that you sent me?
Yes. Yeah, so you have in the Indian Ocean, you have one Macropharyngodon that is called Macropharyngodon bipartitus, that is very similar, except there is a small difference in the fin, in the dorsal fin.
Which one is it again? So, I'm going to make sure I pick up the right one. The
Macropharyngodon.
I got it. Okay. There it is. So that's like an African leopard wrasse, right? Is that kind of a trade name?
Yes. It's the same thing, you know, but except that the one from the Red Sea, you know, it's slightly different, you know. There is just a small dorsal fin difference. But otherwise, they are very similar, you know. And so this one can be separated because there is actually an external morphological difference between the one from the Indian Ocean. But if you take two six-line rice, okay, there is one that is more colorful than the other one, but is it really a different species or not? You know, it's kind of tricky.
So that one is not, so these are not collected for the aquarium trade, but it does look very similar to what is in the aquarium trade. I mean, that's like one of my favorite wrasses, the African leopard wrasse. I mean, it's a gorgeous. Yeah. That's a male, right?
This was pretty good. I forgot about this. You know, I think I don't think it's a male. I think it's a female.
Oh, it was a female. Okay, that's a female.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
When they get bigger, you know, they become darker. You know, if I remember properly.
Yeah, I love those.
I saw only one of that one, you know, so far, you know. So that's the only one that that I saw. I didn't see any male or juvenile.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I'm still learning, you know. I mean, I spend a lot of time planting corals over there, you know, and unfortunately, you know, I don't have so many times to go have fun dives.
Uh-huh.
So, but yeah. So, but every time I go for fun dives, I always find new fish and new interesting things.
So let's Let's go through some of these other fish pictures you sent to me, Vincent, and then we can kind of go through the coral stuff. So, Chromis, basic green Chromis, but there's some other Chromis mixed in, correct?
Yeah, I mean even the Chromis, you know, that I feel they are a little bit different than the one that we find. Yeah, I see when I find them mating,
uh-huh,
parading. I feel that the male have more yellow than the one we find in Indonesia.
Uh-huh.
So even the Chromis, you know, I think they are slightly different than the one we have in Indonesia.
Right. Now it's my understanding is that Chromis are susceptible to a particular disease that makes them very tough to, you know, once you get a Chromis through some retailer in the U.S., I guess the disease can pop up or what have you. But is that something that's
it's a fragile fish. It's not that easy, you know, to handle, you know, and that's a problem with all those fish that need constant feeding. They are hard to keep in aquarium because you cannot feed them all day long. So I think that's the aquarium trade, you know, is actually it would benefit, you know, from having better solutions, you know, for feeding corals all day long, you know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the green chromas have
for feeding corals all day long.
Yeah. I mean, green chromas have been in the hobby for a very, very long time, and I've always had I've always loved to have a school of chromas and antheas because I feel like that's a great way to kind of like replicate what you know, reefs look like in nature.
And they they serve a very good purpose, you know, because they transfer food directly from the water column to within the corals. So they serve a very, very important purpose into feeding the corals.
Chris from ACI says the disease is bringing them up from depth too fast.
It's possible, you know. I mean, it's collecting green chromis. The problem with green chromis is that the value is so low for fishermen.
Right.
That I don't think they can afford, you know, to collect them, you know, properly. You know, it's difficult to collect because they go within the branch and you have to remove them from the coral branches, and it's a difficult thing to do.
Stress.
So the amount of work you have to do to collect them properly, and the price you get from them, you know, actually doesn't match.
That's not a good return on investment in terms of putting in that time.
That's not. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's not a good value for money.
Todd from Champion Lighting and Supply is asking, how many dives does Vincent do on an average week?
Oh, I do 2 to 3 dives a day.
2 to 3 dives a day?
Yeah.
That's,
yeah. It depends. I mean, if when I'm working, 2 to 3 dives a day, you know, and when I'm in Bali, same thing, you know. It's not every day because I need to travel from place to place.
Yeah.
But when I'm on site, it's 2 to 3 days.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
All right. What about the?
Yeah, it's all good. The underwater time, you know, is the best time, you know.
That's the time you enjoy the most, being under in
yes,
the underwater world.
I do.
Yeah, that's best. Awesome. Yeah. Wow, that's logging a lot of hours, man. Pseudochromis.
Yeah, pseudochromis are very interesting in the Red Sea, you know. You have the classic, you know, that the flabby vertex that lives in murky protected bay. It doesn't live in very nice coral environment.
Uh-huh.
And then you have the fitmani that lives in everywhere there is a lot of branching corals. You see school of them. It's like Assessor, actually, you know. You see they live in groups, you know, why the pseudochromis flabby vertex, you know, is alone, is solitary, while the Friedmani, you know, lives in schools.
It's a stunning fish.
Very pretty.
You know, and
same thing as an Assessor. It's pretty similar to the Assessor that I used to see on the Great Barrier Reef.
But they're also aggressive, right? They're kind of tough to keep in an aquarium.
Yeah, I don't know. I never tried them, you know, before, you know. But I think if you get the one from breeding facilities, you know, I mean, they're not as aggressive, you know. And when it comes to aggressive fish, it's all about feeding. Same story, you know. So if they get fed all day long, you know, properly, you know, then they tend to be. If they have space and food, you know, normally they're not as aggressive as if they don't have space or not enough food. But yeah, I think they live in harems, you know, so you have probably a dominant male, you know, and then a lot of female and some dominated males.
Gotcha.
The flabby vertex, I'm sure this one is very, very aggressive because I never seen them. I mean, you see them, you see one every couple meters.
Oh, really? That often?
So they kind of all keep their own territory, you know, so they for sure are very aggressive.
All right, so this is one of my favorites, the Red Sea purple tang.
Oh yeah,
that
me too.
That's a kick-ass fish.
Exactly, you know, that's a very, very pretty fish. I mean, both of them, you know, even the Desjardins, the sailfin tang,
yeah,
is very pretty as juveniles. Is yeah, the purple tang is it's not as common as I expected. You know, I expected to see many of them, but I haven't seen large school of them. You know, I see once in a while, you know, some few adults together, and once in a while a couple juveniles. But they are very skittish fish, not easy to take pictures of.
Oh.
But yeah, very interesting fish.
Where else can purple tangs be collected? Where else are they?
That's the only place.
Red Sea.
That's the Red Sea. You know, so probably, you know, I mean, you find some. I know there is some that go out of the Red Sea and all the way down to Kenya, the North East African coast. And some around the Arabian Peninsula, you know, in Yemen, maybe all the way through Sri Lanka.
Yep.
That's as far east as you can see and find them.
I think they're just they're such a classic, you know, fish to have in an aquarium. They're just beautiful in terms of the contrast of the purple and the yellow. I mean, I love to keep them, and I guess the price went way up on purple tangs. But I think it's well worth it.
Well, I mean, Mr. Sue from Bali Aquarage, you know, produce them from
right.
From they are captive bred now, so you can find them captive bred. So it's one very pretty fish that you can get from breeding, you know. So it's a safe investment. So I put it.
Black tangs, where are they?
No, black tang is from Hawaii.
Hawaii, right? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think there is any breeding right now, you know, of the black tangs.
And gem tang is Hawaii as well?
Gem tang? No, gem tang is from the Indian Ocean. It's further down south, you know, from Mauritius and Madagascar, and so on the East African coast of the Indian Ocean.
John Wright says, my purple tang is called Putin, as he's so aggressive. I guess.
Yes, yeah, they tend to be aggressive in aquariums.
Yeah. So talk more about the sailfin tang, Vincent. There's a couple of different varieties of the sailfin tang, right? Is the this particular one we're looking at indigenous? That's
the one, the juvenile that we are looking at, you know, is Desjardini.
Yes.
So the adults are pretty much black. They are very dark in color, mm-hmm. but the juveniles are very, very pretty.
Very cool.
Yeah. Very bright yellow fish.
Yeah. I love them. All right, here's a name. I'm gonna. This is not a tang, and I'm gonna screw up this pronunciation. The Macropharyne Jodon.
Macropharyne Jodon.
Yeah.
Yes. Maris Rubri.
What's up with this guy here? Is that a butterfly fish?
Well, that's basically the African. African version, you know, of Macropharyne Jodon, the Red Sea version of the Macropharyne Jodon bipartitus.
Is that a rare fish?
Yes. Yeah, it's a rare fish. You know, I've only seen one. You know, that's the only one I've seen.
Oh,
know,
wow.
Over, like, I don't know. I did probably 50 dives in the Red Sea. So yeah, that's the only one.
And that's, I would assume that's pretty rare to see in going into the aquarium trade.
I don't think there is anyone coming
really?
In the aquarium. You know, I mean, this is one of the few. Yeah, because the difference with the East African one, you know, is so little, you know, that most of the people, you know, cannot differentiate them properly, you know, so doesn't justify a price difference.
Gotcha. This is a gorgeous fish. The okay, Thalassoma rupulia.
Yes.
Did I get close yes. to pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
Man, yeah, that is like freaking incredible.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like most of the Thalassoma are very pretty fish, you know, but unfortunately they are very, very, very active, you know, so it's complicated to keep in aquarium, you know, they do a lot of damage.
Like, so they'll eat coral?
They eat other fish, they will bother shrimps, they will bother snail, they're always active looking for food, you know, I mean, they follow you underwater. When we work underwater, when we frag corals, they actually come and eat all the crabs and all the small gobies that the corals and everything. So yeah, they are very active, very aggressive, and eat anything they can find, you know. So in aquarium, you know, they can do a lot of damage, I think.
It's just striking in terms of the markings on that fish. That's just
yeah,
unbelievable, man. Here's another Pseudochromis flavivertex.
Flavivertex.
Yeah.
Yes, that's the one, you know, we talked about just before. You know, it's a small dotty back that is also probably very aggressive, but very pretty. Always curious, so it has a. So when you find them underwater, you kind of hide and seek with them, you know, and they come towards you and look at you,
oh, yeah.
you know, and see what you're doing, you know. They keep their distance, you know, but they're always checking out on you, you know. So it's a nice behavior.
I'm hoping that I didn't screw up some of these in terms of the showing the photos and the file names and all that stuff. I don't know. You're probably not watching on YouTube, but I.
No, I'm, but I have the picture.
Oh,
I have
okay.
The
All right.
Open, you know.
Yeah.
Look at the picture.
But I apologize because somebody mentioned it when we're looking at the wrong fish, but that's probably my bad if that's the case. All right. This is a beautiful angel fish. The Pomacanthus.
Pomacanthus maculosus.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the Red Sea endemic. I mean, same thing also, you know, you can see it, you know, on the East African coast and all the way to Sri Lanka on the other side, you know, but it's originally, you know, a Red Sea endemic, you know. Very, very, very pretty angelfish. And same thing, is a very curious fish, you know, so it will come and... So when you see one, you know, don't chase it, you know, you just try to hide yourself, you know, and look at it, and then it will come to you and check you out.
Big ES says, Vincent is a legend. His photos are so amazing. It's true, man. Yeah, the photography is just incredible.
Yeah, that's my hobby, you know.
That's
so,
your thing.
I mean, it's not very artistic, you know, but it's a lot of, ID pictures. I do ID pictures. But yeah, this angelfish is actually a very, very nice one. I very much enjoyed it. So they always live in groups, you know, so there is like always four or five individual, you know, living together with a male, with some few females, and then some subadults. And it's always nice to find them. They're not very...
Amanda says it's called the Half Moon Angel.
Yes.
I assume that that's not a reef-safe angelfish.
Probably not.
by the look of the mouth on that thing. I could probably say that I wouldn't want to have that in one of my reef tanks, but
it's not a good idea.
No. All right.
Especially for LPS, you know, in an Acropora tank, you know, you can maybe get away with it if it's very, very large. But if you have a lot of LPS, you know, you will go for it.
Yeah. Lyretail Antheus.
Oh yeah, well, I mean that's a classic, you know. I mean endemic of the Red Sea also. I mean, it's we have a species that is similar here in Indonesia, but it's not as colorful. That's a perfect example. You know, we have Pseudanthias chaeospilos here in Indonesia, and they have Pseudanthias quamipinis in the Red Sea, and it's just the same thing, you know, but much more colorful, you know.
What's the
You can see there is one of the picture, you know, where there is a group of them.
Uh-huh.
And you can see the Acropora amprichi, you know, so it's just over a large bush of Acropora amprichi, which is also, I don't think it's the same amprichi that you find in Indonesia. It's different coloration.
Of course, that was one of the pictures I didn't grab.
So, can I share my screen?
No, I don't have it set up that way, but I could try to dig it up.
I probably have it in the there are some pictures, you know, also in the coral section of it.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So the Lyretail Antheus is like one of the antheus that I think is probably the easiest to keep out of all the antheus in the aquarium trade. You know, but they still is it true pretty much all antheus require a lot of feedings and a lot of attention?
Yes. Yeah, so until we can automatize this, you know, I think that's something, you know, that the aquarium industry, I mean, we can automatize the water analysis, you know, how come we cannot automatize, you know, properly, you know, with a simple available product? There are solutions, you know, do-it-yourself solutions, you know, but there is no real product, you know, that to feed fish, you know, all day long in small quantities,
right.
You know, and that's what those fish, you know, require. So sometimes you see them in public aquarium where they have the resources, you know, to actually feed them a lot and very rich food, and their color, you know, is just amazing, you know, they just glow in the dark. But in normal aquariums, usually they kind of lose the color because the food they get is not as rich as they should, and they don't get as much feeding as they should get.
I've heard that they like a lot of flow. Is that what you see in the wild in terms of antheus being in areas of high flow, or not necessarily?
Yeah, it's better to have a little bit of flow. They always on a place that is exposed to food and flow. Yeah, so it's always in a place, you know, high above a boulder, you know, where the current is coming, you know. So, but in the Red Sea, there is not a huge amount of flow.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's.
They are in the place that is the most exposed to food. Yeah.
Right, and I think what's also cool about those Lyretail antheus, I'll usually get like a bunch of them, and they'll be all females, and then one of those females will turn male, which is pretty neat to kind of see the transformation. Yeah. Okay, the Paul Bacanthius Imperator.
Yeah,
so Majestic Angelfish, is that the Majestic?
That's Emperor Angelfish.
Right. Okay, Emperor Angelfish, right.
So it's a common fish, you know, from Indonesia and from all the Indo-Pacific, you know. You can find it all the way, I think, to Tahiti, you know, to French Polynesia, you know. So it's quite widespread, you know. But the one in the Red Sea, you know, just have more yellow. You can see on that picture, you know, all the tails, all the line, and the caudal fin, you know, is actually a very, very intense yellow, you know. And the one that we find in Indonesia, you know, the coloration is not as intense. Uh-huh.
As, What's your favorite angelfish, Vincent?
I mean, the one that I don't have picture yet. So oh, yeah. The one that I'm still for is the Asphere.
Oh yeah.
For Macanthus Asphere. And I'm still yet to get a picture. I've seen them, you know, long time ago when I was in East Africa, you know, but I don't have a picture of it yet. So so I like to find that one.
That's interesting. That's something that you see a lot in the, well, at least I used to see a lot of that in the aquarium trade.
Yeah, because it's captive bred, you know, in Taiwan, it's captive bred here in Bali, you know, so it's easy to get some captive bred one, you know, but maybe I'm not in the right area, you know, but so far I haven't seen anyone.
And that's not that rare, you know, right? I mean, they're not considered a rare angelfish?
Well, I think there are places where they are common, but not where I am.
Question from B Hill 01. Does a Red Sea juvenile emperor angel look same as other areas?
Yes, so it's the differences in coloration is more striking in the adult than in the juveniles. The juveniles are pretty similar to the one we find in Indonesia. So but the adults, you know, they are bright, definitely brighter.
Yeah, it is. John writes, correct, that's stunning. So this next one looks to me like a Moorish idol, and I would butcher the scientific name, the Eniacos intermedius.
Intermedius.
Yeah. Yes, is that a Moorish idol?
No, it's a bannerfish. It's an Eniacos.
Okay.
It's more of a, the Moorish idol is more of a surgeon fish.
Okay.
It's closer to surgeon fish, while the Eniacus is a butterfly fish. So it's different families, but yeah, it's a banner fish, you know. So that's a Red Sea endemic, you know. It's a very, very pretty fish.
Is that rare?
Lives in very shallow water. Not really.
Okay.
You see pairs, so they stay in pairs. So you see pairs of them pretty much everywhere in the shallow water. Very common, very pretty.
Are they hardy? Or are they hard to keep in an aquarium, would you say?
I think they're pretty hardy. They should be pretty hardy, you know, because they live in shallow, warm, bright water, you know. So they live in an environment, you know, that should make them pretty hardy.
Reef safe?
I don't think.
No, yeah.
They're kind of opportunistic, you know, they kind of feed on everything they can find, you know. So if there is a lot of corals to eat, you know, I'm sure if you don't feed them properly or if they are a little bit stressed, you know, or bored, or they will go for corals.
And I would assume they would need...
Can't trust them.
Yeah, yeah. And they, I would assume they would need a bigger tank.
Yeah, see, they become pretty big, you know, they become like at least a good 20 centimeters, you know, so it's a big fish. I haven't seen any juvenile yet.
Oh, gotcha. All right, this next one, this is a stunner. The Pericollinius octotiena.
Yes.
Okay.
Octotiena. So that's the 8 line ras from the Red Sea, the 8 very ras from the Red Sea, you know. I still didn't get a very nice picture of them.
Dude, that's a stunning picture.
Yeah, because you have the male and female together, uh-huh. You know, so it's a nice picture, you know, but I'm still trying to get a picture of a male parading properly, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's not an easy one to get, you know. I'm still working on it. So yeah, so it's the same thing as all the flasher wrasses that you find in Indonesia. They live in places with a bit of current, you know, and a lot of branching corals under, a little bit deeper. And they form large school, you know, so you have like thousands of individuals, you know, living together, and then you have all the male interacting with the biggest female and all the other males.
Nice.
So it's very, I mean, I always enjoy, you know, stopping by, you know, and looking at which male is, which one is the biggest male, because this is the one that you have the biggest chance of getting a good shot at. Uh-huh. And after following them until you have an opportunity. So they move in a very hectic way, you know, so they accelerate, you know, and stop and accelerate and stop and accelerate and stop, which is very difficult, you know, to actually photograph.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the skill, being able to capture that shot, that's got to be tough. I mean, you are underwater, and I can only imagine that you've got to be very quick. And how many shots do you take in a second?
You have to be patient.
Yeah.
You just have to be patient. So you just, I mean, I'm used to take picture. I like to take picture of flasher and fairy wrasses. So you just have to identify, you know, the biggest male that's going to parade, you know, and just try to follow it, you know, and wait to time to trigger exactly at the time when it's going to stop. So usually what they do, you know, I mean, they kind of parade, you know, back and forth, you know, and then at some point they're going to go up and stop. Uh-huh. And this is where you want to get it.
So it's really important to have that knowledge in terms of the behavior of the fish.
Yeah, you need to spend a lot of time in underwater and just watching them.
Are you taking?
I have time, you know. I mean, sometimes I teach underwater, you know. So while the students are doing something underwater, you know, I just look at the fish.
Nice.
Sometimes I don't bring camera all the time, you know. I mean, there is some conditions sometimes that don't allow me to bring camera, you know. And I don't mind, you know. I mean, going in the water without camera and just looking at the fish.
Well, it's a pretty cool thing, man. Just being able to document all that stuff and have it for you know, classification purposes has got to be huge.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of those fish are pretty well known, you know. So it's nothing. There are thousands of pictures already, you know. But yeah, just observing them, and sometimes you get lucky, you know. So I have a fairy wrasse that is named after me, and it's Lemon, it's Sky that actually identify it, you know. And it's just was misidentified. So it was classified as a different species, and I realized that there was three different population that were very different in terms of coloration, but had the same name. And then I just brought it up to his attention, you know. I sent him some specimens, and then it just correctly identified them.
Yeah. Couple of questions, some technical questions. I'm not exactly sure what Chris Carney is asking, but I'll ask that question in a second. Big ES, what is Vincent using for his camera and housing?
So at the moment I have a Nikon Z8 in a Nauticam housing. And I use Ecolite strobes, but I'm waiting for the new backscatter hybrid flash that I want to get into video. Try to do a little bit of video.
I was going
to
ask you, you know, I know you're well known for your photographs, but video is something that you're going to start getting into more?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not patient enough to do all the editing, you know. I mean, like, this is a lot of work, you know, a lot of post work to be done, you know, with video, you know, I always do the same process, you know, on my pictures, you know, so it goes pretty fast, you know. What is the longest is to, I just rename everything with Latin names, so it's easier to find later on. But video, you know, just require a lot of post-handling, post-processing work. And yeah, the big computer power, you need to look into music, you need to look into so many different aspects that you don't need to do in photography, you know. I'm just a lazy photographer. You
know? So, nothing wrong with that.
But yeah, it's like, you know, I mean, it's like I don't have so much time, you know, to actually spend, you know, behind the computer, you know, processing everything.
Well, you got to get somebody else to do that stuff.
Yeah. So that's the thing, you know. Now with Instagram and all this, you know, so people are into short videos, you know, which is much easier to produce, you know, than.
Yeah.
10 minutes, you know, YouTube documentary. But I have many friends, you know, that do video and do video properly, you know, so I leave it to them.
Use one of these things, get an underwater housing for our iPhone or something like that. You could do some easy Instagram stuff.
Yeah. So that's what for the foundation, that's what we use. You know, we have some phones into housing, you know, and we just do, you know, but you still need, you know, proper lighting. If you want to take videos of fish, like the quality of those photography, you know, it's kind of a lot of work. It's very different. You need light underwater. You need a lot of other things, you know, to actually do it properly.
All right. So Chris Carney's question, and I don't know if this is code for something. Vincent, are you on open or closed circuit?
I'm open.
What's that? So what's that mean?
That means it's just regular scuba diving.
All right. That's why I didn't get it.
It's just regular scuba diving, you know. Closed system is what Brian Green and all the other people, you know, use to dive deeper and longer.
Ah, okay.
It's a very different dive style and dive operation, you know. So it's still new, it's getting more and more reliable and more affordable. Yeah, it's just a big investment to get into that.
Gotcha.
I mean you need to invest a lot of money into training, and you need to invest a lot of money into equipment, you know. So
it's getting so windy at the cafe there, huh?
Yeah,
it's getting windy at the cafe.
Yes. Yes. I'll try to remove the background, you know, at some point.
That's,
you know,
that's cool.
I'm in a very place. If I can find how.
I kind of think the rainforest is soothing, but the actual background you're in would be even more entertaining, you think? There you go.
Yes, I changed the background, you know, so I just have to face the other one, you know, but yeah.
Oh, wow, there's the ocean.
Can I move the blur? Or?
Oh, yeah. Now you're good.
Nope. Oh, here you go. Yes.
Oh, cool, man. That's gorgeous.
Yes.
That is so awesome. At some point, we'll have to try to like get you to dive during one of these live streams, and you could you don't have to worry about editing the video. You could just send it back to us live.
Yeah. Yeah.
That'd
I mean,
be awesome.
I will. We'll see. You know, once I get my video lights, you know, then we'll see. If I can do more of this, you know, I mean, there are a lot
fantastic.
Of interesting things, you know. I mean, I do a documentary, like a small, short, 10-minute movie on Red Sea corals or Red Sea fish or some particular types of corals into the wild. I think there is people that would be interested, you know,
yeah,
to watch this.
For sure. All right, here's another fish. Oh, that was the one I already showed. So the Paracolinius octonania.
Yes, so we just talked about it. You know, that's
okay. That's another one.
The Red Sea flasherus.
Do I have the right picture up? I might not have the right one up there. It's got a kind of like the top half of the body is blue, and the bottom half of the body is yellow, and it's got a black stripe down the side. Maybe I screwed up.
Yeah.
Oh no, that's the. I'm sorry. One. That's the Miocin. This Nigrolinius teus.
Okay.
That's what I'm showing.
Yes. Meacanthus nigrolinatus, you know. So that's funny, you know, because there is two species. There is a Nesenius, you know, which is a classic blenny. And the Meacanthus is actually a fang blenny, you know. So the Essenius is a herbivorous fish. They have the same coloration, you know, but the herbivorous fish took over the coloration of that one, which is a fang blenny, you know, that will go, you know, and kind of have some large canines and feed on the scales of other fish. So fish tend to avoid it, and predator tend to avoid it. So there is one small herbivorous blenny, you know, that just took the same coloration.
Nice. Gorgeous. I mean, that's like a really unique looking fish. All right, what about this?
Pretty.
We already looked at this African leopard wrasse. I don't know why I had that there again.
Yes.
Larabicus.
Larabicus.
Yeah.
Quadrilineus. That's a Red Sea cleaner wrasse.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it's much more pretty than traditional cleaner
wrasse. That is so freaking cool. I love the coloration on that thing.
And the juvenile and the sub-adult and adult, you know, and male and female, you know, are actually very, very different. Very pretty fish.
Yeah, that's neat. I've never had a cleaner wrasse in one of my tanks, but are they, they're reef safe, right?
They're reef safe, you know, but they tend to bother all the other fish, you know, after a while, you know.
They keep pestering them to try to clean them.
Yes.
Yeah.
So except you have a very large tank with very large fish, you know, it can be annoying for the other fish.
Got you. All right. Here's a, well, this looks like a swallowtail angelfish. Gineacanthus.
Yeah. Gineacanthus colobitatus, which is the Indian Ocean. Swallowtail angelfish.
Yeah.
So I will probably go and collect that one because I have a friend, you know, that really want one of those fish, you know. So maybe I will go and try to collect a pair of those. They are pretty common, you know. As soon as you go below 20 meters, you know, they are quite everywhere.
Are they? I think one of the most striking swallowtail angelfish is the Japanese mask swallowtail angelfish.
Yes, that's very pretty. I mean, I love swallowtail in general, you know, because they are reef safe, you know, they feed on zooplankton, and male and female are very different, so you can keep pairs of them. They become quite large, you know, so I mean, not as large as a classic angelfish, you know, but they become a little bit bigger, you know, so you still need a little bit of volume to keep them, you know, but they are very pretty fish that is easy to keep in aquarium.
I never had any luck getting I never was able to get a male and a female pair together. I got a trio of females, hoping that one of the females would turn male, but I was never able to keep them long enough for that to happen.
Kill each other.
What's that?
They chase each other and they kill each other, you know, to know which one's gonna be male.
Oh, so they kind of...
I think it's better to get a male with a female or two females.
Is that hard to...
So at least everything sorted.
Does that happen a lot when they get collected? Can male and females get collected together easily or no?
I mean, I don't know exactly, because when they get collected, they all separated.
No.
You don't want to mix any fish, you know what I mean? Like, you only mix, like, green commies and things that's going to be safe. But you try to separate all the fish, so there is no problem.
Yeah.
You cannot deal in large operation with case per case, you know. You have to, you just deal with everything is separated, you know, and then...
Interesting. Wow. All right. This is a bizarre looking fish, man. The Diploropian Draki.
Yes. So that's a soap fish.
It's a what kind of fish?
A soap fish. So they produce a toxin, you know, through their skin, you know, that is soapy.
Huh.
So that's why, you know, so I mean, it's a very pretty fish, but I mean, in aquarium, it would feed on any other smaller fish or shrimp or anything.
It looks,
you know,
like it with that mouth.
Yeah, but it is a very pretty fish.
Yeah, striking.
Yes.
What about the Dascylius Morgan?
Yes. Damselfish. So this is a Dascylius marginatus.
Yeah.
It's a endemic Red Sea damselfish. Very pretty, you know, but same thing as the Trimaculatus or the other damselfish, domino damsels and all this, you know. It's a little bit aggressive, but this could be kept in aquarium.
I see it.
Very pretty, you know, and all the tail is blue. So yellow face, blue tail, and blue scaled.
Yes.
It's very pretty.
Yeah.
I like
really
it.
Cool. I see it.
Not easy to take picture of.
It seems to like to be within the green chromis. Looks like a big school of green chromis there.
Yes. So in the school of green chromis, the Acropora that you can see is the Red Sea endemic, is Acropora eurystoma, you know, which is the equivalent of the Red Sea tenuis.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, not as colorful, you know, but
I like the formation.
Yes.
So this is an amazing looking fish. The Anampsius twisty.
Yes. So that's also classic. You find it all over the Indo-Pacific, you know, but probably that the Red Sea is also an endemic of that one, you know. So Kai asked me to take pictures of many pictures of them to see the differences between juveniles, male and females. Uh-huh. And see if he can identify differences between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific ones. But yeah, this is probably, you know, a few different species.
And that's something that's in the aquarium trade? I don't recall seeing anything like that.
Oh, I'm pretty sure you can get it. You know, I mean, it's a good fish to have in a reef tank because it's going to feed on many parasites and small shrimps small flatworms and small crabs. So it's reef safe you can get it from all over the world. You know, so it should be. You know, it's not very common. You know, but it should.
Is that a pricey fish? Yeah. Do you think?
I don't think so.
Don't think so. Okay. No. Wow. Oh, it's gorgeous. All right.
That's a very small one. This one is only probably, you know, 1 inch.
Oh, wow. That is small. Heron Aquatics. Does Vincent think that cyanide fishing is still happening over in Indonesia for the aquarium industry, and where is it more problematic?
To be honest with you, you know, I have no idea. I have no idea. I wouldn't be surprised. It's still used. Or other chemicals are used. Mm-hmm. It's getting harder and harder for them to find cyanide, you know, so I'm sure they try to find other solutions. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised it's still used.
That's a shame.
But I don't see it, you know. I mean, I don't go out, you know, with fish collectors. Yeah. So I don't know.
So it's hard to kind of tell in terms of signs of being on a reef and seeing perhaps some collateral damage with some fish that might, have been killed and collected.
Where I go diving, you know, I don't see any. So I try to go in places which are nice and we can find something interesting, you know, so I don't go in the places that are completely destroyed and damaged. It's not very obvious to me, you know. I don't go in the places where they collect actually the aquarium fish, so I don't know.
Carney says it's that wrasse we're talking about before, it's a possum wrasse relative.
Yeah. It's pretty close to them.
And possum wrasses are not that hardy, correct?
Well, they are very cryptic, you know. So they live in live deep within the reef, you know. So they live in between the corals. So they don't like very bright light, and if you're gonna put them in the aquarium, you're never gonna see them anyway, you know. So I don't think it's hard. I know they're very common. It's just very difficult for us to see them, because they're always hiding within the corals.
All right, so I know you got a hard stop like in 20 minutes, so I wanna run through three more fish and then we'll get into the corals. So the this is an awesome looking butterfly fish. It looks like the Chatiodon zamir
circulatus. Yeah. That's a classic endemic Red Sea butterfly fish.
Yeah,
it's a very iconic.
Yeah.
It's very pretty fish. I don't think it's reef safe though. They're always in pair and pretty big. They reach at least 15 centimeters or 18 centimeters. It's not a small butterfly fish. So yeah, it's only for some special type of aquarium fish only tanks. And not really.
Gorgeous. Gorgeous.
Very pretty.
This is looks to me like a saddle clownfish.
Yes, so that's the Red Sea endemic, Amphiprion or Indian Ocean endemic, you know, Amphiprion bisinctus. Uh-huh. So in the Red Sea, they only have two species of anemones. They have the bubble tips and the milky anemones. That's the only two species I know. There is a few carpets here and there, and there is a couple magnificent sea anemones, but so far I haven't seen them, you know. But we see a lot of bubble tip anemones, and that's usually the clownfish that you find inside.
And that's a
very bright yellow.
And that's an aggressive clownfish, right?
Sorry?
An aggressive clownfish?
It's probably, in the line of the Clark Eye, you know, so okay. It's probably pretty aggressive.
Yeah.
It's not a very friendly one.
Did I miss? Nope, I got that one. The Sohol.
Yeah, the Sohol, that's a Red Sea endemic, you know, they are everywhere in the shallow water. So above the reef in like 1 meter of water, they are everywhere. They become huge. They are very aggressive.
Badass fish, right?
Badass fish. Yeah, very badass fish. So they just, you know, control a territory in the very shallow. There is a lot of interaction, you know, and they're always parading and fighting each other off. Very, very, very active, you know. So it's a fish that you can keep in aquarium, but it's very, very active and very aggressive, you know. So it needs large tank, a lot of swimming space. and it will be very aggressive with the other fish.
Yeah, that's sound.
But it's a very pretty fish.
Yeah, gorgeous.
Just never stop
oh, really?
Swimming back and forth.
I mean, so another really aggressive tang, and I don't think this is a Red Sea fish, is the powder blue tang. That's an Hawaiian fish, right? Powder blue tang?
Powder blue tang is from the Indian Ocean.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's classic from... Yeah.
That's a really aggressive fish too, right?
That's a really aggressive too, but not as aggressive as this one. This one is much bigger, you know. I mean, this fish is probably a foot long.
Oh, really? Whoa.
yeah, that's a big one.
Wow.
They get pretty big, you know, like the powder blue tang only reach half of this.
Jeez, yeah. I love the powder blue tang. I mean, that is like just an amazing looking fish in my eyes, but I've never had any luck keeping them over long term. Even I'm like, I've added the powder blues to a tank with a bunch of other tangs in it. It was like the last fish I added to the whole tank. And it's still like, after 2 years, like just turned like sinister and was just the biggest bully in the tank. I had two different occasions I had to get rid of them.
Well, I mean, yeah, they become very territorial, you know? So in places like in the Maldives, you find large schools of them because they have to compete with this kind of surgeon fish with like Linnaeus and so on, which dominate the shallow water. They are bigger, faster, stronger. So their strategy is to just cool together and come and graze on the territories of the larger surgeon fish so they can dissipate, you know, the aggressivity, you know, of the larger surgeon fish. While where I am right now, it's actually the eastern part of their range. So they are very range. The powder blue tang are very rare here.
Oh.
And what they do, they mate with the nigricans, Acanthurus nigricans, which is the same, the equivalent, the replacement for the Pacific. And so we find a lot of hybrids here.
Hmm.
All the shades of hybrids, you know, from dark purple, you know, to light purple.
Wow. Sounds amazing. All right, let's rattle through some of these corals, Vince. And if there's any corals in particular that you want to... start with, but I'll just kind of go with what I got.
So we can do the Acropora first.
Yeah. So the I got the Acropora Hempri Chi.
You know, so it's a very, so most of the Acropora are not very colorful in the Red Sea except three species. So this is one of them. You know, Hempri Chi forms large stands, very bright blue. You know, so I'm not sure it would do well in aquarium because blue usually turns gray under blue LEDs. So it's not very bright, but on the reef itself, it's one of the brightest.
It looks a little bit like a humulus, right? But the humulus is more dense branches.
Yes, it's a branching humulus. You know, it's very thick, very strong. It's very hard to break. It's a very digitate branching coral. That is a mixed growing shape, you know, between digitate and branching.
But not very colorful.
Very dense.
Yeah. All right, Acropora. This is a really interesting looking coral. Hempri Chi.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that
so
right?
Yes. Freaky. Oh. It's a very nice one. The next one, you know, that's the one I want to talk about. You know, it's called Pharaonis. I don't know if you have that one.
Let's see here. Oh, yeah, okay. That's what I was showing. The Pharaonis. Yeah, I got
yes,
that. Yeah.
Pharaonis is a large table Acropora. It's light blue color or light purple color, but it's a very fascinating coral. That's the only one that is actually producing large table colonies in the Red Sea. And obviously, you know, I mean, it wouldn't look good in aquarium because the size is, to get the full colony size, you would need a huge aquarium, but it's a very, very pretty coral.
It's
one of my favorite and very, very iconic. You know, it looks like nothing else.
Let me see if I got the right picture here because it's like a wide branching coral, but it tables. Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Yes. Kind of, I don't have any, I didn't use my wide angle lens yet, you know, so I didn't have an opportunity to actually take a full colony picture. So I just have some few shots of
that's
it.
That's really crazy in terms of the branching of that coral. I mean, that's something that I've really never seen before. It seems very unique. Here's another one. This looks like a Piscilla or the Plantagenia?
Plantagenia. Yeah, so that's also a Red Sea endemic. That's one coral that would be good in aquarium. It's kind of Humilis digitate-like. Uh-huh. It has green polyps, so it would look really good. So blue tips, green polyps. It's not very obvious on the pictures, you know, but the polyps are very bright, you know. So it would be nice in aquarium. Same thing, very dense skeleton, yeah. You know, but pretty strong.
Yeah.
Pretty strong.
But not that colorful. It's, I mean, this particular coral is not that colorful. Or
yeah, but I think under blue LEDs, you know, it would look good.
Oh yeah, it would pop under the blues. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, it would look good. You know, because the polyps are kind of yellow greenish fluorescent.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and these were taken under, I'm assuming, like full spectrum kind of lighting, right?
Yes, it's like 5,000 Kelvin light. Mm. So that's usually the strobes, you know, so it's very flat.
Yeah, that definitely mutes it.
But if you would keep this under HQI, metal allied, you know, they would look fantastic.
Oh, really?
All those corals.
That's kind of like a thing that you got to kind of keep in mind when you're collecting corals for the aquarium trade or something, or whenever they're getting collected, that coloration and what they would look like under blues.
You know that red and yellow is going to pop up under blue LED, while blue and purple is going to turn gray under blue LED. So even you go diving, you see very bright blue corals, you know they're not going to look good in aquarium, except people keep them under metal allied. But under blue LEDs, they're not going to look good, you know. So you look for coral that have yellow and red, you know. So if they have a yellow color with red polyps, that's the best you can get.
Do you ever take like a blue light with you when you're diving to kind of try to see exactly?
So I wish, but it only works in night dives because the sunlight is so strong that you can take the most powerful blue LEDs, and it's not going to look.
Gotcha.
You're not going to see it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I haven't found a blue LED strong enough to actually make a difference in full daylight. So that's the problem I have.
Makes sense. All right, here's
it. But at night, it works.
Right. This is a kick-ass looking acro. The Acropora squarosia. Squarosa?
So, yeah, that's... Yeah, squarosa. It's a classic endemic... Acropora, Red Sea endemic, very same thing. It's blue purple, you know. So I'm not sure it would look good, but it's very thick. It's like a thick loripes,
right?
Or thick granulosa,
right?
It's very very characteristic. It's very pretty.
I can't recall ever seeing that kind of formation.
It's very unique.
Yeah.
Very, very
unique. That's cool. That's a coral that Jake
actually
would love, right?
I still want, you know, I spent like 15 minutes, you know, looking at it, you know, and
that
try to organize. So like the branches, I mean, it's not very obvious on the picture, you know, but the branches are probably, you know, like a couple centimeter thick.
Holy crap. That would be a coral that that Jake would be drawn to, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And even the Goniastrea that is next to it, you know, is a very it's a Red Sea endemic.
This is a Acropora variolosa.
Yeah. You know, that's pretty similar, you know, than the squarosa. So squarosa, you're gonna find it deeper, and the variolosa you're gonna find in the shallow water. It's in between Amprici, and it's very very characteristic, you know. It's somewhere, you know, it's like a thicker loripes, you know, but with pointy branches.
Nice. Yeah.
It's very nice too.
All right, here's a couple of blastomusas.
Yeah, so the Red Sea and Persian Gulf endemic, you know, the Blastomusa loye. That is actually pretty common, you know. It's not very spectacular underwater. It looks like an encrusting favitis. And then you have to look closely, you know, to look at and see that the polyps are separated. They have separated lobes and corallites. I haven't seen any very colorful ones. You know, those ones have like a blue mouth.
Yeah.
But I'm still going after them. It's a very neat coral.
Yeah, amazing.
And unique Red Sea, you know, so that's why I was very excited to find it.
Here's a Cocinaria monili.
Yes. So, that's I don't think it's a Red Sea endemic. It's a Red Sea and in Indian Ocean endemic. But yeah, it's very, it's like almost like a Leptoceris, a massive Leptoceris, you know, it's very interesting.
Yep. Here is a, this is looks very unique, the Dipsotradia tradia, Mathiae.
Yeah, so that's also, you know, I mean, actually this one, that picture is from Indonesia, you know, it got mixed in in the loop, you know, it's not a Red Sea.
Not
one.
A Red Sea.
Sorry
all
about
right,
that.
That's cool. We'll, yeah. How about this, this looks like a really unique one, the Echinophilia. Is that a pronounce?
Yeah, so it's Aspera, you know. So that one, you know, the red one, you know, there is not many Echinophilia, but some of them, I start to find some which are very colorful.
Almost looks like a chalice.
Yeah, it's a chalice.
It is, okay, yeah. this is a, the, Echinopora fructulosa?
Fructulosa, yes. So that's Red Sea endemic too, you know. So that's the Red Sea has many different species of endemic Echinopora. They are very, the polyps are larger than the one that you usually find in Indonesia. So fructulosa is a branching Echinopora, which is kind of neat. We don't see many of them, and that would be a very nice coral that I would love to have in aquarium.
So Ken Cherubini is asking, is there a list of these acroporas that we can access after the podcast? I'll by tomorrow, I'll put a list of all the corals and the fish in the video description to help. I'm translating for Keith. Thanks, Amanda. This has been hard. It's been hard. But I don't know, Vincent, man. You're like, you're sort of understanding what I'm saying. So seems to be working. Galaxia. I know how to pronounce that.
Yeah, I get it. Galaxia.
That's a kick-ass looking Galaxia.
Yeah, so, yes. Galaxia from the same thing. You know, I mean, I think Galaxia is a... It's a genus that should get a lot of work on it, you know, because there is definitely, you know, more than 10 or 20 different species of Galaxia fascicularis, you know. So this is the one in the Red Sea, which is very different from the one in we have here, you know. So it lives, it's always shaded. It doesn't live, you know, directly exposed to the sun. It's always under other corals in holes and cracks on the reef, you know, and get mid lighting, partial lighting. So it's kind of a cryptic Galaxia, very different from the one we have here.
That's bitching. That's pretty freaking cool. All right, here's a Gyros milia interrupta.
Interrupta. So that's a Red Sea endemic. So that's one coral that you find only in the Red Sea, you know. So I had a discussion with Julian Sprung about it, you know, and he thinks there is two different species. There is a shallow species and there is a deep species. So those two ones are shallow water ones, but I've seen some deeper ones.
Really cool and unique.
Yeah, it's not very nice corals, you know, for aquariums, you know, but for coral nerd like me, you know, I enjoy it very much.
Yeah, for sure. all right, so Montipora, Montipora meandrinia.
Meandrinia. So there is a lot of this, you know, very, a lot more colorful than the Indonesian version. Very bright blue, bright purple. It's a very nice coral.
Yeah.
Very massive.
Yeah, awesome. This is just a, you got this label as a Montipora. Looks like an orange
Monty. Didn't have time to go and look for the exact species. No, probably a Montipora mollis or something like that. You know, bright orange color.
Yeah,
it's also this one would be popular in aquarium.
Yeah,
definitely. You know,
yeah,
because the color would pop up under blue light.
The Mycidium.
So yeah, that's definitely a Red Sea endemic. You know, it is nothing like the Mycidium we have in Indonesia. So it's definitely different.
Yeah, that's all. I've never seen something like that.
So you see all the polyps sticking out. It's definitely a Mycidium, but it's definitely a different species. It's not Elephantotet or Robokaki. It's a different species.
Awesome. Here is a this is a really cool one. The Paramonstrea.
Yeah. Yeah, Paramount Astrea parisii. It's a Red Sea endemic. You find it in the Persian Gulf also, you know, but it's a very characteristic pink color Red Sea endemic. Very pretty.
Yeah, color. Really cool. This is unique. The Proites.
Yeah, so there is a lot of Proites in the Red Sea, and I think like I didn't get into it. I didn't take so many pictures of them yet, you know. But I think there are a lot of endemic. Proites ross is widespread all over the Indo-Pacific, but I think the Red Sea one is actually different. So I think it's also an endemic species.
Really unique. This is like one that I can pronounce. Nystalophora and the Pistilliata. It's something I used to see a lot. You know, I think we used to see a lot in the aquarium trade, the bright, bright pink Stylophora.
Yes.
And it seems like it hasn't.
So I think,
what's that?
I think this is what has become the Milka.
Oh, you think? Because I always thought the Milka was a lot more purple.
Yes, but in aquariums.
Oh.
And I haven't seen anything like real purple Stylophora. There are a lot of Stylophora in the Red Sea, you know, a lot of.
Uh-huh.
But this kind of skinny branches, you know, with bright pink and yellow tips, you know, is pretty common. And the same thing, you know, I mean, it's also an endemic. At some point, you know, somebody will look into the genetics of this, you know, and they will
That's
find that there is enough.
That's interesting. That potentially could be the Milka. But I used to have like this just hot pink stylo that was one of my favorites. BG.
The ones in Fiji are very pink.
Oh,
very
pink. Gotcha. Yeah. All right, a couple quick Tridacna squamosa pictures.
Yeah,
of
so
clams.
This is something very interesting. You know, the Red Sea doesn't have a huge diversity of clams, you know. It has three different species, squamosa, maxima, and the other one, which is squamosina, or I think, you know, that's the hybrid between, but there is a lot of them, you know, and then the reef is covered with maxima clams everywhere. So maxima clams are everywhere on the reefs of Red Sea, you know. They are very very important component of, if I had to make a Red Sea aquarium, I would put a lot of maxima clams, Turbinaria reniformis, the yellow Turbinaria, and a lot of Millepora corals, the hydro corals, the fire corals. So I would put a lot of this. That stuff for me are the three endemic corals and mollusks of the Red Sea. You know, that would be the foundation of a Red Sea tank.
Well, if we had more time, I would ask you some more questions about that, Vincent. But I know you got to go, man. So listen. So again, how can people help support what you're doing there?
So we have an internet website that's called oceangardener.org. So that's Ocean Gardener. You can see this. That's the logo and the thing. So you can do on the website and you can help us. We offer some courses here in Indonesia, you know, a coral reef restoration course, which is a 4 weeks course where we do 1 week coral ID, 1 week coral gardening, 1 week coral reef restoration, and 1 week monitoring. So if people want, if divers, they need to be divers, they need to be advanced divers. But if people want to learn how to do coral reef, it's basically, you know, I mean, aquarium work, but underwater.
Nice.
At a larger scale. But yeah, it's very interesting. If some people are divers and want to learn about coral reef restoration, we offer courses here in Bali, you know, so where you will see a lot of corals, you will handle a lot of corals, and you will learn how to plant corals underwater.
That's pretty friggin' awesome. That's so unique,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I like aquarists, you know. I like when I get clients, you know, that are aquarists, you know, they will usually do very well.
Cool. All right, well, listen, Vincent, man, I want to thank you again for spending this time with us and helping to educate
yes.
us, and thank you for all the work you do over there.
Thank you very much, you know, I appreciate it, you know, anytime, you know. I wish I had more time, you know, but it's the dawn of the day, it's 8:30 in the morning, you know, and I need to do some work.
Yeah, you got to go, man. All right, well, listen,
all right.
Thanks, Vincent, appreciate it. And you can take off there, Vincent. I'm going to thank my sponsors one more time. Sure. But
thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to thank Polo Reef for being the sponsor, one of the sponsors. Make sure to check out Polo Reef's new YouTube video that drops this Friday. Part two, where Andrew discovers mysterious white spots on many coral colonies and calls for an emergency dive in the aquarium. Join them as they try to figure out what is happening, and also check out part one that dropped last week. Make sure to subscribe to the YouTube channel at Polo Reef for video drop notifications. Champion Lighting and Supply, besides being a place for hobbyists to purchase saltwater aquarium supplies online, Champion Lighting is also a wholesale distributor for many popular brands. If you own an aquarium store or an aquarium service company, contact Champion Lighting through their website at championlighting.com to set up a wholesale account. Todd and his crew will be at Restock Chattanooga August 24th and 25th, so stop by and say hello. Thank you also to Fauna Marine. I do use the Fauna Marine Reef ICP Total Test Kit, which gives a quick, accurate, and easy overview of over 90 water values in reef aquariums, from macro elements to trace elements and pollutants. You get a complete overview with corresponding dosage and action recommendations. I am now a certified Fauna Marine ICP test advisor, so if you want to help with interpreting results and select reef pump. Big thank you to Paul, who's also the moderator, as well as the president of the Boston Reefer Society. Please join and support your local reefing clubs. They are so important to this hobby. Also want to let you know that all episodes of Rappin' the Reef Bum are available as podcasts on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Amazon. All right, next week, this is going to be an incredible show. We're going to have a little bit of a smackdown with some reef-keeping legends next Tuesday, August 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Yes, this is going to be a very interesting show. We're going to have Julian Sprung, Charles Delbake, Mike Paletta, and Sanjay Yoshi on the show. So this is going to be a roundtable discussion. Don't miss it. These are icons of the hobby. I have a bunch of questions, but please come with your questions. This will be a fascinating show. So until next time, be safe and be well. Later.